welcome to Afterthought, a National Public podcast with us, Jeff and John, the RPG brothers. And we're broadcasting this week from the Educational Testing Division here at System Mastery Plaza.
And this comes to us from a single source claiming to be answers that school students gave on history papers regarding religion and the Bible. That source was Richard Lederer's great essay.
So these aren't like SATs or anything, like yes or no
questions. Oh, well, no, because these are multiple, those would be multiple choice. So here they are. Here's a few of them. The inhabitants of Egypt were called mummies. They lived in the Sahara Desert and traveled by Camelot. The climate of the Sahara is such that its inhabitants have to live elsewhere.
It's also the climate of my wife's house.
All right, Moses led the Hebrews to the Red Sea, where they made unleavened bread, which is bread made without any ingredients. Jacob was a patriarch who brought up his 12 sons to be patriarchs, but they didn't take to it. One of his sons, Joseph, gave refuge to the Israelites.
That seems pretty charitable.
Always giving them Israelites refuge, sir.
If I don't need my refuge, I might as well give it to some Israelites.
Here we go. Solomon, one of David's sons, had 500 wives and 500 porcupines.
That's a lot of trash to take out.
Knowing my wife, I'd rather sleep with the porcupines.
Well, look, if you're shocked at how little folks know, just stick around, because this is the Afterthought Podcast, and even though paladins fall instead of choosing to listen to us, we're a free national podcast, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to the System Mastery Podcast. Or, I'm sorry, to the Afterthought Podcast. Welcome back. As always, I'm Jeff. My co-host John is here with me. Say hello to the nice people.
Woo! What is up, everyone?
And for a very special event, we actually have a guest on the Afterthought Podcast.
Oh my god, it's amazing.
This never happens. Or no. At least it has never happened before.
It's never happened before. We'll wait 10 minutes and have another guest.
Drink some milk. So our guest this week is James D'Amato of the One Shot Podcast.
Thank you guys so much for having me for this very special episode. We're going to be talking to you about drugs.
Yes, yes. All of the best drugs.
Where are they? How can I get them? Which ones should I mix with the other ones?
Yeah.
If I've been injecting them, is there a way that I can instead stuff them under my toenails?
All this and more. On Afterthought.
What we're actually here to discuss today is micro role-playing games, or little baby role-playing games that are one or two pages long.
Yeah, that is the
role-playing games for babies.
That is the technical term, is little baby role-playing games.
Little baby role-playing games. They had their own daytime TV show on Nickelodeon in the 90s. Little baby role-playing games. They'll dance around and stuff. But we did a recent episode of our System Mastery Podcast where we covered a number of little micro role-playing games. One of them included was Gangland, which was James's game. We had a great time with it.
Oh, I'm glad you guys liked it. I listened to your character building sessions. You guys really nailed it with the gang themes, especially being a tribute to Aquabat videos. That's exactly what I was going for.
That's what we were hoping. Our thought was that this was literally based around the Aquabats video Fashion Zombie. And if it wasn't, then, you know, it probably should be. So we wanted to make sure that folks knew.
Now, a lot of people were confused. They thought the Warriors inspired it, but no, it was clearly the Aquabats.
Clearly.
I mean, who gets inspired by the Warriors these days? That movie was in 1977. I mean, granted, it's the best 70s movie, non-Star Wars edition.
Ah, there you go. Okay. Yep. I'll buy that. I was going to say, we had some words.
I know. You got to, it's not even the best movie of 1977, if you count Star Wars. But but not counting Star Wars, I think it blows away all those other films in their sheriff's offices, and long conversations on piers and mustaches.
Establishing shots and big cars.
Oh my gosh, the 70s. All right. So, we read five different micro-RPGs, kind of got a taste for the genre. Neither of us have ever really been micro-RPG folks before. We hadn't really read them, but we love them.
Oh, yeah, they're absolutely great.
It's a beautiful form.
Yeah, I thought so, too. I haven't read a few of them from a writer named David Sherdwan, who had a series of contests he had run for 200 word or less micro RPGs.
Actually, Kat was a judge for that contest.
Oh, that's cool. I had no idea.
Yeah, a lot of great games came out of that. I think it was a brilliant idea, and I know David's a great designer too, so there was a lot of great content generated out of it.
Yeah, we're already in talks with him to have him come on and talk about his current game. The cool thing for us with reading those was that they were so in flavor. Like, every one of them, the rules for the micro RPG so deeply complemented the flavor of the story that they wanted to tell. It was awesome. We didn't cover any because they're just too short to cover. But they were great. Okay, so we wanted to start off with a couple of cool conversation topics on micro RPGs. So I'm going to step back and ask my first one, which is micro RPGs. If I play one of these, am I still a virgin?
You know what? No, I don't think so. I will say that micro RPGs, like one of the big things coming out with micro RPGs is the people with these micro LARPs. I don't know if you guys have heard of the Golden Cobra LARP design contest, but it's very similar in that they're really short, premise-heavy games. And today, LARPs are really different than they used to be, or at least there are still boffer LARPs where you run around in a pig mask with a sword in the woods throwing spackets at each other. However, there are also these really intensive feelings, emotion-based LARPs that are all about heavy premises and deep exploration of character. And I gotta say, that crowd is not a virgin crowd.
Well, if there's one thing that I have learned from all of my friends that have done LARP, it is that everyone is sleeping with everyone.
It's true for my LARP friends, too, yeah. I mean, I've never actually been... I've been to a LARP for 5 minutes, and then I left, because they wouldn't let me play as an Egyptian vampire. But from the times I've spent talking to my friends about it, yeah, that's a pretty sexed up crowd.
Yeah, so I'm going to say micro RPGs. No, you are no longer a virgin anymore.
You lose your virginity if you play one.
You are now part of the indie gaming scene.
Keep that in mind, folks, with indie gaming purity rings.
Yeah. Just remember, it always counts if it's a micro RPG or butt stuff.
All right, now for a real question. What do we think about the concept of micro RPGs as gateway role-playing games? Something to kind of catch your friends that aren't role-playing game folks and bring them into the fold and turn them into real gamers.
John, you want to start on this?
Well, I think it's definitely a very good one, depending on which one you do. And because there's so many to pick from, it gives you a way to even progress along the RPG that are the micro RPGs. So you can start with one that's a little more party game, doesn't involve dice, doesn't involve a lot of the trappings of an RPG. It's much more like an improv game at that point. And then moving on to some more ones that have dice mechanics to them, and then moving from there to go, all right, look, if you like that, there's more games like, say, a Fate or something like that, that is still light on the dice and the rules, but can still get them into that the mindset of I'm just improvising and having fun and doing a character. And then from there, you can get them right into Phoenix Command.
Yeah, Phoenix Command is the next logical step.
Well, I totally agree with that assessment. I think that it's a lot easier for somebody to wrap their head around a game that really only has rules that are on one sheet of paper. It's the difference of, you know, saying, hey, I want to play a board game with you, and bringing out something like Apples to Apples or Settlers of Catan, and then like bringing out something designed by Fantasy Flight where there are 10,000 pieces and it's going to take 7 hours and it's a huge commitment full of rules that nobody has a chance of understanding on their first playthrough.
What's that game you have in the trunk of your car, John, that's the size of a battleship?
Twilight Imperium.
Twilight Imperium, exactly. So it's just a much smaller commitment for people, and it's easier to get somebody to sit down and start playing. The transition from you deciding to play Everyone is John and actually playing Everyone is John is 5 to 15 minutes. It's even shorter if you're playing with me, because I have a lot of random draws for your abilities and your obsessions. It's just...
Oh, hey, that's a good idea.
Way easier to get somebody to commit to, like, yeah, I will spend an hour or 30 minutes playing Lasers and Feelings or Everyone is John than I will spend you know, 2 to 5 hours to build a character in Pathfinder.
Well, yeah, you also have a much smaller degree of system mastery in a game like that. And if you want to know about System Mastery, System Mastery Podcast. It's the choice of a young generation.
Yeah, no, I think the key to the future of role-playing is cutting you guys out of the equation.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely obviously. Right. All we're doing is negative impact on the industry. We're trying so hard to fix that, but until we do, for now, we're just the demons of the industry. We're the Statler and Waldorf, and it's the worst for everybody.
Oh man, pitching you guys as the Statler and Waldorf of role playing is perfect.
All right, the next question: do you have any good experience with using these games as party games, and do you think they make really good party games?
Absolutely. I will say I have run these games on the show a ton, and I've run them at conventions a lot, and they're one of the few games that I can run with like up to 8 people. And it's because it's just so much easier to play these games because it doesn't take as much commitment from people, and I can hop from person to person and mix their input to the game so much more effectively than I can do with a more intense role-playing system. And that's because it's lighter, people feel like more light and airy about it, and they're not so much caught up in, well, I need my character to do their cool thing. They know that wherever entertainment is coming from, it's coming from, you know, people making ridiculous characters and putting forth ridiculous ideas more so than them getting to be the last person who hit the monster before it died.
Yeah, I think really the amount of time you spend on a character is going to affect how much time you want to spend in the limelight with that character. Because when you're making them, you've got this concept in mind. You're thinking, all right, I want to be, you know, this type of barbarian, and he comes from this background, and I want to make sure that he does this cool thing because I got this weapon. But in a micro RPG, I mean, a lot of the times you might not even know who you're playing until you sit down to play. So at that point, it doesn't even matter. You're like, oh, I just want cool things to happen.
No, I agree with that. We actually, after doing our show last week, we took the game Dr. Magnet Hands to our local nerd store. And just wrangled up people we didn't know and played 4 games of it in a row.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was crazy fun. And yeah, the whole character creation thing was a blast. I since all you do is take one of the cards you have written down and play as your character, it was real easy for me to slip into character as Jack Salami, you know, semi-retired and semi-hard private porn star, or whatever it was you needed. What's yours? Someone was playing as Helicoptosaurus Rex. That was fantastic. So yeah, I agree there. Do you think, however, that they can be used to run long campaigns? Can you actually run a long campaign in a micro game?
It really depends on the micro game that you use. I know, because I judged a contest called the 2-Page Tabletop Design Contest, and that was put together by a company called Top Secret Games, and I don't know that they actually ever followed through on putting together the book that they wanted to make out of that contest. But because of that, I read over 100 2-page tabletop designs.
Wow.
And I will tell you that there were definitely some games in there that had planned in progression, and it was good, interesting progression. There's a designer called, I'm going to butcher his last name, but it's Ryan Olathe or Ryan. Yeah, Ryan Olathe. He is not American, obviously. He's from Ireland. And he designed a game called All Things Truly Wicked, which is a sort of children's imagination horror game. And it's fantastic. The entire concept was able to be expressed in 2 pages, but there was obviously a lot more meat there. And he left you just enough that if you wanted to, you could take the free version that he put out for the 2-page tabletop contest and use that to run a full prolonged campaign. And there were tons of games in that I saw that, oh yeah, you could absolutely use this game to run a prolonged campaign. I mean, there's not as much meat for your crunchy players, even though there were some games that did try to go for that. But yeah, if you have no other options, there are tons of micro RPGs that you could run indefinitely.
See, I think that's really interesting because normally when people think about a micro RPG versus your standard RPG, I think a lot of people think of micro RPGs as just being these one-shot, almost party game, just, you know, very throwaway. And the idea that you would be able to have one that is much more about, I'm going to have a full story that's being told, not just in one little goofy session, but being able to take it seriously and then being able to weave a full campaign out of it. I think that would be really interesting and fun to do as a player as well.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And it puts a lot less pressure on whoever's running the game, because again, at that point, just like the players don't need to know a million different things and have their system mastery for whatever game is, your person who's running it doesn't have to feel like, okay, I need to know not only everything the players can do, but every monster and every bit of treasure and everything like that. So I think it's a really great idea for doing a decent campaign.
I feel like a lot of role-playing games, if you were to strip out a vast majority of the cruft that's built up in them, kind of the sacred cows of role-playing design over the years, they would end up being micro-RPGs.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at one of my favorite role-playing designs ever, which is Dread, the horror system played with a Jenga tower, that mm-hmm. entire game could be expressed on a single note card. But there is a full, like, I think it's a 100-plus page book that gives you advice on how to play and flesh out the story more. You could cut so many games down to just being one or two pages of core information, and then everything else is actually what makes that information interesting and what makes you want to play the game.
Right. What about marketing for micro-RPGs? It's already a tight industry. I mean, a lot of the folks who are writing the big books are pretty much paid in love and internet hate.
But, yes.
But what are the sales models I know you're currently working on a game, so if you want to talk about your own sales model and the other sales models you've seen for micro RPGs, for people who are interested in writing and designing these little guys, how do you actually benefit from them?
So that is a tricky thing to express. I know John Harper, who designed Lasers and Feelings and mm-hmm. other great one-shot and smaller systems like Lady Blackbird, designed a bunch of these smaller games. And then he put out this year a Kickstarter for a larger game called Blades in the Dark. And that Kickstarter was very well received. And Harper got rewarded, you know, finally, for all the hard work that he'd been doing. But really, a lot of the benefit of micro games is building up goodwill. And it's not goodwill like, oh, look, somebody's putting out a free game. It's like, oh, somebody knows how to design a game. So if they put out a larger game, I'll know that it's a safe investment to back their project, because it's like these smaller games have been so good. And I think a lot of people, for their first role-playing game, one of the reasons you guys have so much material to go over in System Mastery is people decide, oh yeah, I'll put out a 900-page core rulebook that has a batshit crazy setting in it and 70 different skills, because that's what I care about in role-playing design, and I think I'm ready to design a role-playing game like that already.
Yeah.
Turns out that's a lot of work, and when companies like Wizards of the Coast put games out like that, they have a lot of different designers working on them and a lot of different freelancers adding to those books, or the people who are putting out those books have put out a ton of other gaming material and they know how to do things like be consistent with their rules and have a singular voice when they're writing a game. Even Gary Gygax, the first person to work on a role-playing system, had the help of Dave Arneson, who really made it into what we think of as a role-playing game, mm-hmm. and he had tons of experience designing games before then. He was very active in fanzines, creating rule supplements for existing war games. So by the time he created Chainmail, he already had a ton of design under his belt. And that's because he took on smaller projects that he was able to finish and review and learn from. So when you're designing a role-playing game, making the first project you do a one or two page role-playing system helps you A, understand design, B, get your name out there, and C, learn how to design with a directed vision. And that is something that I know a lot of the young designers who have participated in these role-playing design contests, like the two-page tabletop or David's 200-page tabletop design contest, have benefited from, just because they learned something about what it takes to actually design a game. And, you know, they're ready to move forward in their careers with a more complex project, having started from square one.
Yeah, I think especially getting the goodwill and the experience under your belt, not even just the experience for your own benefit of being able to design something, but just so people can point to something when you're putting anything out and go, look, I've got a history of being able to do this. I've made X, Y, and Z, and these have all been great. You can trust me when I'm doing my new project. So someone I know put out a Kickstarter campaign for a Pathfinder setting that they were putting out.
Mm-hmm.
And they put so much effort into this. I mean, they had maps. They had a full giant book. They had like all of these perks set up for, like, you can get this amulet if you are going to be at a certain level. We have DVDs of, wow, like, full video of, oh, if you're, wow, in the caverns of whatever, here's a video of the entire caverns. And just poured money into it before the Kickstarter happened.
Oh,
and then,
boy,
the Kickstarter went live, and of course, no one knew who they were or what this was about or anything like that, and just did not go over well.
That's the modern heartbreaker right there. It's,
oh yeah,
putting...
I was watching it happen, and I'm just like, oh, that's just sad.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a reason that our show lives and dies between 1977 and 1993. A lot of folks have sort of caught on to there being rules for how you write role-playing games and where you start. And honestly, speaking as system mastery, it's a good thing. Well, there's so many old games that we can trash that we're thrilled that the industry is going so well and so progressive now. So it's for us, it's a great thing. One of the things I noticed when I look through the micro RPGs, and I read about 20 of them to get a feel for which ones we should cover for our show that we did, that there were a lot of folks who were eschewing dice as a mechanic. They were moving towards things like crumpled up pieces of paper, coins. We saw one, of course, that was sticks of bubble gum. And then a personal favorite of mine was one that used matches, and the matches represented a resource you owned until you burned them. And then that resource was gone to you. I thought that was amazing. So talk about the use of innovative mechanics to progress a story.
Yeah, I love that idea, because I think, especially when we had talked originally as the gateway for other RPGs, most people look at dice as being sort of nerdy and anything with more than six sides as being very just in the realm of roleplay gamers. And if you aren't already in that world yourself, then it can be a little intimidating. And I think it does fit in the setting of the game. So if you're using something like those matches and you burn it and then you don't have that anymore, it feels very flavorful to do something like that. Or if you are spending sticks of bubblegum until you are all out of bubblegum, that's a great feeling to tie into the game you're playing. So I absolutely love the non-dice mechanics, even though I do love rolling dice, because it's just physically so much fun.
Speaking only for my own house, I can say that I would have a way easier time finding a D10 than a match. Okay, what do you think?
I think the fact that these games are so small is what allows people to make such big innovations in design. It is a huge risk if you're going to design even a 50-page role-playing game that is about burning matches instead of using traditional role-playing skills. These games free designers to really stretch themselves and look at what haven't we used as an entire field of design to accomplish our goals of, you know, figuring out a risk reward system. I'm currently working on a new edition for Ganglands, which I'm still using dice, but I'm switching over to D12s, and I'm changing the game from rather than simply rolling dice to basically playing marbles with dice. There'll be an area that's in bounds for your rolls, and you can try and knock your opponent's dice out of bounds to make it so that their rolls don't count, or even just knock a die to a different side so it's not as effective as it was. It's a really weird design, and it's probably not one that could be mass marketable, but for a smaller game, it's something that I can test out and see, A, if it works at all, and B, you know, if it's any fun. And if it is, you know, I could probably explore it for a larger game.
I think that's actually really awesome. I love the more kinetic games that you occasionally find. There are a lot of board games that have, like, the discs that you have to fling, and killing monsters is, like, you have a disc that represents an arrow, and then you have to flick it at a disc that is the monster and hit it off of things.
I remember that board game. That game was awesome.
Yeah, I loved those types of games that give you that alternate way to play rather than just, say, rolling dice or moving around a board. And so I think the idea of having not only rolls, but then rolls within sort of an arena that you have to knock someone out with, it works really well.
Yeah, and that's like some deep hobby shit too, because one of the original war games, Little Wars, I think that was Asimov's
Wells game.
Yeah, that used, or was that Wells? That might have been Wells.
It was H.G. Wells' Little Wars, and or for boys and for girls of a particular mindset or something like that.
Yes, yes.
I've been pushing for us to cover it for a while, because ripping into H.G. Wells is got to be, it's like I dream of it at night.
Got to take him down a peg. Yeah, but he used like a little peg launcher. It launched little wooden dowels at the soldiers, and that's how you would fight. These things that we think of as weird and being totally off the wall are things that just as easily could be a normal everyday part of design, but because the industry has been set up in a particular way, we don't have it. And that's why so many of the games that you guys review, these Heartbreaker games, have the same stats as regular D&D, or have regular D&D stats and then some, because people are working from a limited palette, and smaller games like this allow people to expand that palette and see what will work.
It's absolutely true. I find myself amazed whenever I read a game that doesn't have obvious dexterity, obvious constitution. I mean, I know they're called agility and toughness, but boy, you're not fooling anybody. So, okay, the last question I wanted to ask you, and you've already talked about it very briefly, was your own game, Gangland. Now, we covered Gangland for a micro-RPG show, and we had an awesome time making characters for it. It led to a lot of interesting letters that came back to us with people designing their own gangs, and we're going to talk about some of those in a bit.
Oh, man, that's so fun.
Oh, yeah, it was awesome. It was really fun, and we picked right up on the Warriors thing, because Warriors is, again, it's our like our favorite 70s movie, non-Star Wars edition, so it was super good to see something that was really catching that sort of zeitgeist of, oh, the gang is everything, and everything is 100% serious around the gang. People, this is not a joke for anyone involved.
Yeah.
So, but we know that you happen to be working on a new Gangland, and we wanted to give you a chance to talk about that, tell folks where they can look into it, when they should expect it, if they should be expecting it any time, and how they can help you support it.
I have been lightly thinking about this and tinkering with the idea since the two-page tabletop contest closed, because originally, before I was selected as a judge for that contest, I was going to enter that contest. And I came up with Ganglands, and it's been heavily influenced by designs of John Harper's, so Your Lasers and Feelings. And
which we loved.
Yeah. Which, I mean, Lasers and Feelings is a great game, which is so obvious why I took wholesale so many ideas from it, because it worked really well. I wanted my game to work really well. But after the contest, I saw how many innovative ideas like came in and I was hit with, and I looked at Ganglands and I'm like, well, this was a fun little project, but I could probably push it farther if I really tried. So I sat around, I thought about my theme, and I came up with the idea of, since gangs are essentially fighting over territory, why not reflect that in a marbles type game where there is a territory that you're rolling in and you're trying to claim as your own? So all the abilities in it are going to be revolving around this thing I call the turf, which is basically just a 1 foot wide circle. And people are going to be rolling inside that, drawing little circles inside it, doing all sorts of things to the territory around that in order to get some strategy. So it is a very kinetic focused game that still has the randomness of a die game. And I'm working on that for the publishing company that Cap Murphy, my broadcast partner, and I have called Paracosm Press. And we're going to be launching the website on that very soon. And when we do launch the website, we want to have a couple games up there. So you're probably going to see Gangland's first edition up there. I'd say second edition is still... I'd like 60% done. There's right now, I just need to add a lot of detail to it and play test it a little bit to see what works and what doesn't. But I'm excited to put that one up there, because I think people might have a lot of fun with it. And you know what? If it doesn't work, there's still Gangland's first edition, which I do think works just fine.
Absolutely. Now, I didn't know you were a publisher, so I think we're going to need to want to talk to you later about a little something called Duckman.
I can't acquire the license to that. That's a Fox product, right?
It's Klasky Supo, I think, is the owner of the license, and they're dead in the water, so it might be available for a song. I have no idea.
Yeah, I'll offer them a ham sandwich.
I really wonder if they would like... I mean, Rugrats is coming back, so that company is probably going to be back in the money.
Yeah, pretty soon here, but... I don't know. We're joking. Our real love these days is the Blimpleggers campaign setting. That's our new baby. So anyway, John, wait, what am I asking you for?
What are you gonna?
I'm leaving you alone.
Like to plug Gangland for a second, if you don't mind.
I'm sorry, I was so into the format. All right. Instead of that, we should now move to our listener mailbag.
Yay! Let's listen to a mailbag.
Yeah.
What does a mailbag sound like? What does it have to say? Putting mail in me is my fetish.
Yeah, fill me up. Yeah.
So the first question we have is probably a little deep, instead of jokey and funny, but you know, I figure we might as well ask it anyway. The way I see us doing these, again, because James is remote, we have to make sure we take turns so everyone can be heard and it doesn't turn into a jumble. I'll just give everyone a chance to answer these. But first question comes to us from David Friedman, and it's, here we go. You're getting roped into this, James. You don't necessarily express these views. You've mentioned on previous shows how much you like Fate, and your recent episode on microgames had lots of praise for systems where rules are very closely tied to the setting fiction and work to support it, e.g., there only being two possible actions in Lasers and Feelings. I don't debate that these sorts of rules make a game easy to get into and well-suited for one-shots, but when playing a long campaign-style game, don't you find the limited number of possible rule interactions in these sorts of games limiting? Fate Core has 5 approaches, and D&D 4th Edition has a handful of powers you will invoke dozens of times each before leveling out of them. You've talked about jokey shtick powers getting old in comedy games. Do you not find the same problems with strictly delimited powers in these games? Where's the happy middle between freeform and defined, interesting abilities that inspire good character design? John?
Okay, so we have definitely talked a lot about the rules light and the comedy games and how certain things can feel a little stale after you've used them too many times. And I think that comes from, at least in the comedy games, if your shtick power is you throw a pie, you don't have pie-related powers, you don't have control over various different forms of pi. You don't get to translate that into 3.14 pi. It's just, no, my power is literally throwing a pi at someone.
Right.
Whereas I think in the micro games, it's more, you have options. You have open ideas that you can do. And so it's not, oh, I'm playing a micro game that's, okay, you can only do either lasers or feelings, but Lasers and Feelings covers literally everything that you could possibly do.
Yeah, I feel like dragging Fate into this is a little misleading. Fate doesn't have 5 actions. It has infinite actions, of which there are 5 ways to represent with dice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and not even just that. Like, I could see somebody, like, looking at the aspects, the character aspects of Fate, and going, oh, well, my character is just these 5 things, you know, obviously leaving out full Fate, which also has talents or is it talents or it's whatever. It's whatever talents and your skills. Fate might seem limiting because your character is cut to the core on those five different themes, but I don't find that limiting at all. I think that means you're always being true to your character while you are doing an unlimited amount of things.
Yeah, I think it's the difference between I've got a character that has these things that he wants to do versus I have a character that can do this specific action. And it's the, all right, well, if I've got a character that really likes talking, I'll try and engage in diplomacy, or maybe I'll try and talk my way out of something. Whereas if I have a power that specifically I can throw a pie at someone, then every problem needs to be solved with throwing a pie.
Right. And that's specifically going after the game Tales of the Floating Vagabond, which has pie throwing as a mechanic.
Yeah.
But realistically, the problem with Tales from the Floating Vagabond is it has those shticks you can purchase. And then once you purchase the shtick, it never changes. But the people it's based on, the people that that shtick came from, they change all the time. You have things like, oh, my power is throwing pies. I have the Marx Brothers power. Except the Marx Brothers do all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
So I mean, ultimately, that's a problem I always run into when I'm reading through. And I don't want to single out Tales of the Floating Vagabond. He's still working on Lee Garvin, the writer of that, working on the second edition, which looks like it's going to be fantastic. But the thing for me is whenever I read through those joke games, it's often one joke, and that's supposed to hold you through a campaign. I mean, you hear that kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't problem with 4th edition D&D in particular, where people say, oh, this game has way too many powers to choose from, but once you choose them, you only have these powers?
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's not really... The problem with 4th edition, I think a lot of people ran into a hang-up of reading the little text description of, you know, what, for example, the fighter power Come and Get It does, and they go, well, that's all it does. That's all it'll ever do. I yell at all the monsters and they surround me. But really, it's just, you look at it as the rule mechanic, as monsters slide toward you two squares or whatever, and then you get to make an attack against them, and then you interpret what that means. Do you throw out a lasso? Do you throw marbles on the ground and they roll towards you?
Are you spinning so fast you create a vortex and monsters get sucked into you?
Exactly. That's the sort of thing where people say it's delimiting because you have so few powers you can use, but it's up to you to describe them and come up with a way that they become, and this is a Fate term again, stunts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with you guys wholeheartedly, especially about comedy games and having like limited options and actions for you. I don't particularly like games that are set up like Apples to Apples or Cards Against Humanity, because I think it cuts the creativity out of, you know, the playing that you're doing. So I don't like a game that just hands me a table or hands me an ability and goes, here, this is funny, and you are expected to only capitalize on this. I do think it's weird to draw a relation from games like that to systems like Fate, which, although they don't have the mechanical complexity of a game like Shadowrun, it's not at all limited. It's only limited by your imagination. And if you can't look at something like Fate and create new ideas out of it, then perhaps Fate is not the system for you. I won't call you creatively bankrupt directly. I'll just say that you're somebody who needs a lot more suggestions and a lot more premises to go off of. And
I'll just call you imaginatively bankrupt behind your back behind when your I'm back. Talking with Becky in the Starbucks.
Becky and I have been ripping this dude to like apart. His shoes are awful. But yeah. I mean, some people just prefer their playstyle to be more like Dungeons and Dragons 3.5 or Pathfinder, just have a ton of crazy options available to them all the time, and they just go through those until they get bored and level up.
Yeah, and I had that problem when I was transferring out of my early gaming life. I was a Rifts player originally, and when I realized I could play games where I didn't have 70 distinct skills with 70 different percentages of how good I was at them, that it didn't actually hurt my character. Like, I don't need to know how good my character is at boat building. If boat building comes up, we'll figure it out then.
Right.
Was the basic model. So, yeah, I agree there too. Let's move on. Next question coming to us from Kurt Sutter, good friend of the show. But he's asked us a couple of questions. Unfortunately, he is not the Kurt Sutter who wrote Sons of Anarchy. I've hoped that we could trade answering his questions in exchange for getting to hang out with Leela for a day, but it just won't work out. So he says, time travel is invented, and you three are given the task of bringing karmic justice to Hitler. Always with the time traveling Hitler. The only catch is you can't do anything that would severely mess up the timeline. You have to be karma chameleons, as it were. What do you do to give Hitler his just desserts?
Oh,
I'll go first. Well, John, you want to just, I'll run through what we have.
You go ahead and go do yours.
All right. The problem with this is that there's really not much I can envision to do to Hitler that's worse than what Hitler did. So actually, assuming just desserts is kind of difficult. If I just wanted to you know, kind of slap him around a little for his troubles before he kills himself in a bunker, which is fine with me, is a way for Hitler to go. But basically, our basic plan here at System Mastery is to use time travel to get him right before he dies.
Yeah, no, this is my original idea when I first heard it, was go back in time right before he kills himself in the bunker. You grab him, you bring him forward to your time, then you put Hitler on trial in your time, so that way you don't mess up the timeline. He gets his full trial, everyone gets a free nut punch, and then right before he dies in your time, you bring him back to the bunker and let him die there.
Doesn't break the timeline, yeah.
Yeah, that keeps the timeline intact. You know what? I'm probably just going to go put a banana peel behind him so that when he steps backwards, he's going to slip and hurt himself before he kills himself in the bunker.
I want to die, but I also have the hurt elbow.
Oh, no, it was the funny bone.
Why do they call it the funny bone? It's never funny when you hurt it. Yeah, and what's the deal with airline peanuts?
Oh, so now he's Hitler Project Comedian. He's just, who are they trying to keep out of these things, right, Eva? Oh, you killed yourself. Never mind. Oh, man. How'd that get to the dark place? Why is it always Hitler in the time travel scenarios? I want to go back in time and mess with someone else.
Yeah, let me go back in time and put a banana peel behind Jesus.
Yeah, or Oscar Wilde or something.
Yeah, Mao and Stalin were pretty bad dudes. Like, you could go after them.
Yeah, or just not even involve yourself with a horrible mass murdering dictator type and just mess with someone who history remembers, but that's all.
I went back and switched out Marie Curie's coffee for decaf.
Let's see how that treated history. I went back in time and gave James K. Polk a wedgie.
There you go.
All right, next question. Coming to us from, our good friend Mickey Jesus. Mickey Jesus. And he asks, guys, are mutton chops a good choice in facial hair? James, what do you think?
You know, I'm not a fan of facial hair on myself, generally. And I really have almost no opinions about other people's facial hair. But if you are wearing, like, this is a time period where right now facial hair is in. That lumber sexual craze is like all over the place, but mutton chops, I think, still look weird. If you are a person who has just mutton chops or has your mutton chops connecting into a mustache and you're looking around and not everybody else has that, you have chosen something deliberately weird.
If you've taken the Lemmy.
Yeah.
What do you think, John?
I think, okay. So if you're kind of chubby and you're in a ska band, have some mutton chops. That's fine.
Yeah.
You go ahead and do that.
I'm going to say if you're Martin Van Buren or if your last name is Bull Roarer, then it's okay for you to have mutton chops.
If you're part of British aristocracy, please have some mutton chops.
If you're a hobbit, it's okay to have some mutton chops.
If you are a hobbit that is part of British aristocracy and your name is Martin Van Buren, by all means, why don't you have mutton chops?
You're missing out. Also, why aren't you an illusionist? All right, next question. Hey, I really enjoyed your review of Gangland. Here's a hypothetical for you. Oh, and this question comes to us from Jeff Blizzard. Below are three gangs. Please describe how they would win in a contest of their choice and which you think would have the ultimate edge to reign supreme.
Ooh.
Okay, and the three gangs, which I assume we have to determine which contest this gang would win individually.
Do you want to give each gang to one of us?
Yeah, I think that's the best way to do
it. Okay, each one of us can have one gang. And I'm just going to go around the room. John, you're going to be controlling the Moons Over Miami.
All right.
And let's see. James, you're going to get the Rudy Tootie Fresh and Fruities.
Rudy Tootie Fresh and Fruities.
And then I will be controlling the Sausage McGriddles. So, John, what contest do you think the Moons Over Miami would excel in?
All right. Now, obviously, the Moons Over Miami are night farmers as a gang.
Night farmers. That's their theme, night farmers.
Their theme is night farmers.
Okay.
So they've got, obviously, a pig farm. Duh.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they have the Moons Over Miami.
Okay.
And so their big contest is going to be pig wrangling. The greased pig, if you will.
Oh, yeah. The old greased pig, they call it.
The old greased pig. Now, this is definitely a contest where they're obviously going to have more practice at, but it's also one where if you can beat the Moons Over Miami at their own Greased Pig contest, then truly you have won their respect.
Okay. And James, what do you think a contest the Rooty Tooty Fresh and Fruities would excel in would be?
Well, Rooty Tooty Fresh and Fruity is clearly some sort of gang that spawned out of an ice cream parlor.
Okay.
And I believe that in this town, like, they've got to face off against the Carvel boys. And the way they do that is by building an ice cream sundae as high vertically as possible. You're obviously not allowed to extend out from the bowl that you start with. So they, through a complex series of stacking and sprinkling, have to build a taller ice cream sculpture. And because their ice cream is thicker, they're going to take it.
All right. There you go. They have thick, custardy ice cream.
Yeah.
All right. So how are the Sausage McGriddles doing their business?
Now, I know you're probably assuming that because I have sausage in the name that I'm going to be a rival gang for the Moons Over Miami, but I want you to know that I'm going deadly serious with this, and the Sausage McGriddles are an 1820s band of Irish immigrants living in urban New York that compete regularly with gangs like the Treacle Gang and the Black Rabbits, and... Their only real interest is in carving out turf for themselves, being deadly serious, and attempting to control the meatpacking industry, obviously. So there you go. And between these three gangs, and mine's going to be controlled by some really good character actor. I don't know. I'm going to say Brian Dennehy leads them.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. People are crazy for that 1820s era. That's really Gangs of New York. It'd be great if there was one gang called the Sausage McGriddles in that. McDonald's paid out the nose to get them in there. Okay, so now we have to fight the three gangs. Who do you think takes it?
Well, I mean, we got to decide what we're fighting with. What's the contest?
Oh, you're right. We have to set our terms. I'm going to go with Hot Air Balloon Race.
Hot Air Balloon Race. All right, you know what? I think the Rooty Tooty Fresh and Fruities can take it. If it's set up the way I'm envisioning, I think this gang is led by a Kurt Russell character, and it's just a bunch of 13-year-olds with Kurt Russell. Oh,
so it's kind of like a kid's soccer team sort of situation.
Yeah, exactly, like a kid's
like
soccer
the Ladybugs.
it's in a viciously violent gang-torn dystopia. where they're air balloon racing around the city.
John, what do you think your prospects are?
Well, I think Moons Over Miami going to be led by Brian Posehn.
Oh, that's a solid guy. Yeah,
In full overalls and very, very just dour about everything. I don't think they're probably going to win, but the nice thing is they take their pigs in the hot air balloon for extra gas.
Ooh, that's good. Yeah,
lots they of got gas. That nitro.
Plus, they have a lot of pigskin on hand, so they can make a really solid balloon from the pigskin.
How dare you think that they would ever harm their precious pigs?
Fair enough. And I just realized I said Brian Dennehy earlier, and I meant to say Brian Blessed.
Way better.
Right? I want Brian Blessed to lead my gang. And I think they could do fairly well in a hot air balloon race because we're talking guys who are living and working 83 years before the invention of the airplane, but 200 years after the invention of the hot air balloon. So this is all they know when it comes to air travel is hot air balloons and hot air balloon racing. Unfortunately, they don't know anything about hot air balloon racing, but they're not distracted by petty airplanes.
Yeah.
So I think they have that going for them. And of course, they have Brian Blessed just open mouth yelling at them.
Yeah, God forbid Anthony Hopkins get involved, though. Blessed would get distracted. And they'd have to duel it out.
Leading the Hardee's biscuit sandwiches.
It's okay. I've got Daniel Day-Lewis as one of my pigs. He's really method about it.
You're going to lose then because it's just going to your entire balloon race sequence is just going to be a close-up on his face.
It just keeps getting closer to Daniel Day-Lewis's face. Oink. Oink.
Bristling his mustache. All right. Okay, next question comes to us from, there's a couple here, and these are from Greg Holton, and Greg wants to ask a few dumb questions. First one, standard good nerd question, and we'll just take it around the room. We'll start with James, and we'll go from there. Who would win in a fight to the death, Batman or Iron Man? Just give me one quick reason why your guy would win.
Ah, man, I normally hate giving this answer, but I think it's Batman, and I think it's because he would work harder.
Batman, because he would work harder. All right, John?
All right, I'm going to give it to Iron Man, because he's going to work smarter, not harder.
All right, I'll give the traditional nerd answer. I'm going to give it to Iron Man, and that's because Iron Man doesn't have an annoying no-kill code. So when he fight to the death, he'll fight to the death, where Batman will fight to win and then lose because he didn't obey the letter of the rules. All right. Next one. We'll do the same question order. What is your favorite Magic the Gathering color?
I play blue.
Blue's a good color.
I know that's annoying. Although I think my favorite is to play as artifacts, which is why I only ever really played during Mirrodin blocks.
Fair enough. Yeah. John?
Definitely going to be black. Mm. I am all about killing things and raising things from the dead. Absolutely love that. Anyone who plays blue, terrible human being.
But black-blue decks are fantastic. That's okay, I'm going to go with a weak choice that no one would ever pick as their favorite color, but I'm a total Timmy, so I'm going to go with green. I really enjoy green because I love big, stompy creatures, and I love the style of I have more stuff than you, which is the green play style, is to kind of get as many things out on the board and have more land and more creatures, and they're bigger. I like that. I like having a large force out on the field, so I'm going to go with green. And the final one, he actually offers us a big old list here, but I think we can go without the list and just say, what is the best fighting game?
Oh, is this video games?
Yes, video games. Okay. That's the list here.
I am going to say I was a big fan of Guilty Gear.
Oh, that's a good one. And it's doesn't appear to be on the list, so right off the bat, we're going off menu, which is fantastic. I really liked Guilty Gear, too. John?
I never did play Guilty Gear, actually. I think I played it, like, twice in the arcade.
The high definition is so much fun in that. It just looks prettier than every other game that's 2D, anyway.
Yeah.
What do you think, though? What's your favorite?
I'm going to go with the most fun I had playing was probably the old X-Men Children of the Atom.
Ooh, the one that led into all of those sequels, like X-Men versus Street Fighter and so on?
Oh, yeah. It got weirder and weirder as it went until you got that Marvel versus Capcom 3 we've got now. But I think that original Children of the Atom was so awesome for me because at that point when it came out, I was so used to like Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter and just like, oh, okay, whatever, fighting games. But being a huge child nerd, I was like, oh my God, I can be Iceman and just keep yelling, Ice Beam!
Yeah,
Ice
you can play
Beam!
As Juggernaut. And that game had Akuma as a secret character in it, which was just shenanigans. If you don't know, world, I'm a huge fan of the Marvel Capcom franchise. It's my jam. Although, I'm going to say my favorite fighting game ever is Smash Brothers.
Oh, that's a good one.
Because Smash Brothers is playable by anybody.
Yeah.
You can really develop your favorite character. You get in there and you're like, oh, I'm going to win, and I'm going to beat you with this round pink beach ball thing. Here we go.
I will throw a shout out to one of my new favorites, Towerfall Ascension. I guess that's kind of a fighting game. If you guys haven't checked it out yet, you should.
No. All right.
Oh, yeah. No, I know about Towerfall. I have yet to play it, though. It looks real cool.
Oh, it's real good. It's got that same Smash Brothers setup in that it's really easy for anybody to pick up and hard to master.
Nice. I like that. All right. We have a couple questions here that are specifically in-jokes related to you, so I have no idea what these are about.
Oh, great.
But the first one comes to us from Tears HTML, and he wants to know, James, why is America gangs?
Why is America gangs? Well, it's because of New York City, the most American place on earth. Way back when, they divided the city up by ethnicity, and we sort of have been clumping together ever since. And that's the beauty of America as the melting pot. We're full of hateful little clumps.
We're the chunky beef bits in the beef stew of America.
Yep.
We're the movie, the clumps of the world.
We are the movie Meet the Stupids of the world.
All right, and then the second one here, I'm gonna let John do this because he's got a better voice for this than I do. And again, it's specifically addressed to James.
Okay, so this has to be in your best dwarf voice. So.
Yeah, our dwarf voice, the System Mastery dwarf voice.
Right.
Hey,
right.
So I saw you on Geek Week. Nice suit. Where do you get a nice suit like that, eh?
That was a Jay Hilburn suit. Real Italian, real nice.
You gotta get that real Italian suit. Come on.
What are you, not swinging an axe over here? You swinging a hammer?
Never mind, he knew.
Everyone's on board with Italian dwarves.
Yeah. Italian dwarves is the new normal.
Let's just switch the ethnicity of every fantasy race that we've been working with so far.
Oh, yeah, we've done that a few times. If dwarves are Italian, then elves are, what did we say, German?
Oh, God.
Because you got to give them something that doesn't make sense. Like, normally you'd think, oh, well, elves are going to be French. You're like, no, that makes too much sense.
Yeah, it's too obvious. Make them German so that they're all hard and mean about it. Gnomes are American now. Yeah, it's fun. All right, here we go. This one's a little open-ended. Been a really long time. I had meant to write earlier. I wanted to ask, and this comes to us from Brooke Kara. Oh, last question from Listener John. He signed it Listener John so that we wouldn't just say it was you.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Okay. This one comes to us from Brooke Kara, and it says, hey, been a really long time. I had meant to write earlier. I wanted to ask, what would be your favorite place to travel or to live, and have categories for the U.S. and the world? John, you want to go first?
All right. So favorite place to travel that I have not been to. I've always wanted to go to Ireland. I don't want to actually do anything in Ireland. I mostly just want to hang out and drink and maybe sit on a hill somewhere and just sort of chill out.
And let's say in the U.S., and let's go ahead and say you're allowed to have been there already.
All right. In the U.S., my ideal travel is I want to do a road trip, and I've been wanting to do this and planning this for a while. That is a road trip up to the House on the Rock.
Okay.
Full of, if you don't know what it is, then check out American Gods, because that shit is great.
It's right on, too.
And I've been to the House on the Rock before, and it's great.
Yeah.
But I want to do a trip that is all the weird, like, sideshow tourist trap things. Do a road trip that's like, I'm going to go see the biggest ball of twine. I'm going to go over here where someone's got a dog that's bigger than a horse.
For me,
whatever it is, I want to do a road trip that ends at the House on the Rock doing all of those.
I've always wanted to do a road trip that factored in a lot of abandoned concrete dinosaurs.
I thought you were going to say abandoned concrete buildings and just go in there, you know, just murder people.
Just go into these abandoned concrete buildings and cook meth, you know, a real road trip. Okay, James,
really,
what do you
American
think?
Stuff. For the United States, I really, really like Colorado, which is sort of a cheating answer because I grew up there. But man, it's a beautiful place, and it has gotten so much better since I have left. Denver used to be like a sleepy nothing town, and now they have some of the best breweries and restaurants imaginable. So Denver, real grade A stuff.
And then you've got the world to go to.
The world. There is a small town that I went to in Italy called Spoleto. And there, it's like where a bunch of master chefs like have their vacation restaurant that they run. It's like
nice.
they go there to like work on their craft or whatever. The food is amazing and really affordable. It's also built on top of a medieval town, which is in turn built on top of a Roman outpost. So there is so much history that you can look into. Like, there's a Roman aqueduct that you can look at. There are like something in this tiny town, like 13 different medieval churches and a bunch of different architectural and archaeological sites just around the place. It's beautiful.
Okay. For me, if I'm sticking to the United States, I have never been to Chicago and always wanted to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would probably be mine. Not only is the One Shot Gang there and I'd love to hang out with them, but also that's where my sister lives. So one of these days I really need to get over there.
Well, that's the only reason I went to Chicago was my sister was living there, but absolutely great. Every time we went there, it just turned into a let's go to every restaurant that's awesome.
For a second there, I thought you'd only ever gone to Chicago for my sister.
Yeah. Yeah, I only ever visit your sister in Chicago.
But no, yeah, it's a place I've never been to, and I'd really like to see it, and the restaurants just sound phenomenal. My dad's literally there right now, and I'm super jealous.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, so there you go. Chicago's my place in the country. In the world, I think I'd probably like to go to Akihabara in Tokyo in Japan.
Good choice.
Because Japan just seems like it'd be amazing. I'd probably pick up the train pass and go all over the country if I could, but I'd like to come home with just bags full of RPGs.
Gundams,
RPGs. I don't really have any Gundams. I should have some Gundams because I love models.
Well, if you go to Akihabara, you got to come back with a Gundam. If you don't, then I think they arrest you.
Actually, there's a place in Akihabara that's been my dream to go to since I was a kid, and it's a used video game store, and it's called Super Potato.
That's weird, because that was my nickname in high school.
Mine was Beef Waves. But it was Super Potato, and there's the only picture I've ever seen of Super Potato, there's a guy standing in the aisle, and he's got a video game, and he kind of looks a little dopey, and he looks exactly like me. Like, he looks like my clone. It's like if I'd already been there and forgotten. So ever since I saw that picture, it's like, I need to go. I need to find the other me that's already at Super Potato. So, yeah, that's a thing. I would like to visit the Akihabara District of Japan and Chicago. Great. So, I think that's it. Oh, she also wanted to know that she knew Space 18... I hope this Brooke is a girl, Brooke. I hope Brooke knew. She says, I knew Space 1889 was bad, but I'm really sorry that you didn't have fun reviewing it. That's not true. We had a great time reviewing it.
We have fun reviewing everything.
We're total masochists. You can send us anything, and we'll review it, and we don't care if it hurts. That's the way the show works. So don't feel bad about that, Brooke. Keep sending us garbage. We will cover it.
We will cover ourselves in garbage.
We already know what our safe word is, and it's fatal. Oh, my gosh. Someone just sent me the super... did you just send me that?
Yeah.
The picture from
Super
Potato?
So this is exactly what you look like?
No, that's not what I look. It's a different picture.
Damn it.
This picture is from like 10 years ago.
Oh, but I wish he looked like
that. I know, that'd be way better. It'd be way easier to sit next to me. No, there was... The guy... Just picture a dumpy guy with a beard, and you're on the right track.
Okay.
Anyway, I just lost my questions. Let me just get back to those real quick. By all means, send us anything as long as it isn't fatal. Next question. This is a fun one. Who would win in a fight between Rift's characters and Exalted characters? Both sides have the same number of characters, freshly generated, and the GM gives the Glitter Boy pilot plenty of time to start up his mech before the fight starts. John?
Well, apparently we've got a Glitter Boy on the Rift side.
I think you get to pick the best stuff, and we're probably... I assume that he means we have to stick to the core book.
Okay, so out of the core book, that means Rift's characters, we've got a Glitter Boy pilot, a Samus pilot, and a Hatchling Dragon.
Yeah.
Versus some...
Exalt,
some Solar Exalted.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and say, depending on the system they're fighting in, it's going to go either way. Because if they're fighting in Palladium, I don't think Exalted characters... baseline have mega damage, so I think if they get touched, they're gonna explode.
See, I feel like you're off base there, because even if, I mean, we don't have rules for them, so we don't know if they're mega damage or not, but we do know they're supernatural beings, and supernatural beings basically always get mega damage.
See, but they have the same health track and soak as a normal human in the Exalted system.
That is a good argument.
So if they use a stamina charm to become more resilient, I'll go ahead and give them mega damage.
All right. What do you think, James?
This is a blind spot for me, because I am not a super crunchy system expert. I am going to say America wins for watching this happen.
That is true.
All right. And then I guess we have a few more things. Since you're blind on these, we'll just wrap it up real quick here. John, what if the characters were max level?
Considering levels don't matter for Rift's characters, then same thing. And if it's max level for an Exalt, they win hands down because they are perfect at everything.
Yeah, they're just gods, and everything misses them constantly. That's true. Okay, and then what if you added Cinnabar characters to the fight?
Well, then it becomes a dance improv fight.
That's correct.
Obviously, the Winged Warriors and Live Emotion.
Live Emotion, yeah. Man. You cannot defeat them.
No. Their theme is dance improv. Dance improv. All right. So that question came to us from Ryan Marshall, a big friend of the show. So thanks, Ryan. And last, I think, question comes to us from Lauren Brinkman, and there's a few of them here. And the first one, I think we should do this one in a different style than the way the question's asked. The question is, for all five Star Trek series, what character was the best at each of the roles on the ship? Now, I think instead of doing that, what we should do is we should crew our own Star Trek ship using the gestalt. Who do we pull
okay,
for each
so,
role?
Okay, so we got to do roles that we're going to do our captain,
mm-hmm.
First mate,
mm-hmm.
Chief Engineer.
Okay.
And we're going to have Chief of Security.
That's an important one.
And our Helmsman.
And a Doctor, I would assume.
Yeah, you got to have a Doctor.
Doctors are terrible.
No, we have two for Doctor. We're going to have
okay,
to
okay, fine. We get a Doctor.
So let's go around the room and each person gets a pick until we run out. So, James, you want to start? Who's Captain?
Yeah, it's going to be Picard.
Obviously.
Of course. Picard's going to be the big favorite here. I mean, I might float Sisko just because he eventually is a Captain and I love Sisko. But he starts as a commander.
Who didn't?
And
his
he does
thong
command
song
his...
was really impressive work. So
he put so much energy into that thong song. I don't think anyone has ever sung more dramatically about anything than Sisko sings about thongs.
That final breakdown in that song was just like, girl! I'm like, oh my God, you are so into this. Like, I thought you were just kind of pervy, but this is a passion.
Yeah, no, it's a real thing for him. You have activated a sleeping dragon. We love Sisko. Okay, so Picard's the captain. And I guess, John, you want to tell us who the first mate is?
Well, obviously the first mate, we're going to go with Spock on this one.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
you could go with Riker, but then you basically have the Enterprise helm.
Yeah, but you want to have Spock because I think he's going to complement Picard a little better than Riker did. Because Riker was always off being a philandering ladies' man. And I think Spock would have a better time getting along with Picard.
I think the two of them would get along famously.
Yeah.
I think neither of them would really care about Chakotay, who I assume would just stay in his room.
Obviously.
Yeah, so Chakotay's just right out. And I don't even remember who the first mate of the Enterprise from Enterprise was. Was it T'Pol?
Maybe?
I don't know. I have no idea who was what on that ship. So, okay.
Well, we got Kira. We could go with Kira.
Oh, Kira is awesome.
Yeah.
Especially if Mirror Universe Kira is in play.
Ha ha ha!
Okay, that leaves me with what? Do we want to do Chief Engineer?
You want to do Engineer?
Okay, I have Chief Engineer, and that means I'm going to have to go... God, there's not a lot of great options. You know what?
Well,
I'm gonna...
two are the same between two
I know.
Different shows.
Yeah, there's two... Well, actually, it depends, because Geordi LaForge was the first Chief Engineer. Okay. So, and I do like him, but the thing is, all the storylines about Geordi are about how he's just terrible and bad with women and nerdy and awkward, and he never gets better. so I'm going to throw a dark horse out here and give this one to B'Elanna Torres.
Ah, B'Elanna.
B'Elanna Torres, the half-Klingon chief engineer from Voyager, which shouldn't win any awards for anything, but there is a scene I remember with her that I enjoyed, which is when Janeway gives her the old, how long will it take? 1 hour. And she goes, you've got half an hour. And B'Elanna says, no, I said an hour, because that's the literal minimum amount of time I would require to do it. Don't give me that nonsense. This will be done in 1 hour. Exactly. And Janeway was like, oh, okay, I see we're going to have that kind of interaction. I always liked that. So I'm going to throw it to B'Elanna Torres, and that means that it's coming back to James for the security chief.
Oof. Okay. Star Trek is not one of the things that I know most. So I'm going to have to pass on security chief.
Oh, that's okay. Aww. That's all right. John, you want to take it?
Okay. Well, it's... God, I'm going to go with Odo, because if you go with Worf, then...
Well, you're just
going to
lose.
Well, yeah, if your chief of security is just there to show how awesome the guy is when he beats him up, then that's just sad for you.
Yeah.
Odo, however, was great, and then later in the series, he can just show up and be like, I was the cup all along.
Yeah, the first season, they actually had a budget for him to transform into things, and then as the show progressed, it was just him popping in like in a Greek play. Someone would pop in and be like, there's a crazy dragon just off stage. And he'd be like, he'd pop in and go, I turned into a cool tiger, but we didn't show that. I guess that leaves me doing the Doctor, and then we're done. And let's see. Who are my options? I got Bones. Bones is really solid. I got Phlox. Phlox can eat it. Beverly Crusher had a weird episode where she was where she suffered attempted rape by a Scottish ghost.
Yeah, that happens.
And she's a package deal with Wesley Crusher.
Oh, that is
oh,
that's a
column.
That is a drag. And I'm going to go with the best possible Doctor, the Doctor.
We're going with the Doctor from Doctor Who.
Theoretically, he could be on Star Trek, you know.
He could be, but no, I mean the emergency medical hologram played by the amazing character actor Robert Picardo, who not only is an amazing doctor who just can't leave his office, but he's also on like four different Star Treks. He's in DS9, he's in the movies, he's on Next Gen, he's on Voyager. He just shows up everywhere, and he should. Because Robert Picardo has been around. And that guy is one of the best character actors on the show.
It's a way to get another person named Picard on the ship, which is, you know, a better shot at success.
It's true. Okay, and this was a good one. This is definitely a movie mastery themed question, because we complain about this constantly. What's your favorite and least favorite type of movie filler?
Ooh.
Which is, what is the stuff they throw in a movie just to make the movie longer?
Okay, so least favorite for me is definitely establishing shots with cars. When you just have a car driving somewhere and you just let it linger for several minutes of like, oh, I'm going around this bend. Oh, now I'm going over here. And now I've gone around this way. I'm like, I don't care. Get to something happening. That is my least favorite type of filler.
I will say my least favorite type of filler is establishing shots of the Los Angeles skyline. I don't care if it's Beverly Hills or just LA in general. There's always that. And then you're going to get, every time you see the LA skyline, you're going to get some 90s garbage guitar. That's like the rule.
Yeah, you're going to get some guitar from the band Garbage in the 90s.
Now, that hurts, because Garbage was amazing in the 90s.
It's true.
James, do you have anything on this?
I'm going to say checking in with tertiary characters and having nothing happen.
Oh, yeah. What's going on with this guy? Oh, nothing? Okay,
oh, he's
great.
Is he still hacking the mainframe? Great. Can we get to somebody shooting somebody?
That's good. And then I don't even know what best filler is.
Best filler is, I'm going to say, when you check in with a side character and they're doing something interesting. When you just go, all right, we've got like our main characters, they're doing whatever. And then we check in with like his goofy friend who's off doing whatever. And it's just a weird scene. I love that shit. It doesn't have any bearing on the plot, but as long as it's an entertaining scene with a side character, love it.
I just realized what mine is, and I'm going to keep it in theme. I hate establishing shots of the LA skyline. I love establishing shots of LA butts. So you give me some beach scenes where there's a lot of bodybuilders and hard bodies in bikinis walking around in G-strings, and for some reason there's two roller skaters. That's my favorite filler. James.
Whether it is a kung fu fight scene or a action movie chase scene, I love it when they cut to somebody who is going to be affected by one of those things. So like it's the fruit cart like setting up his fruit for the day and then we see it get taken out. Like it's clearly just we got to add 15 seconds to this film somehow, and you do it by ruining somebody's day. It's great.
I like that. And I like that you're doing it as a setup first. Like, it's not the fruit cart getting hit, but rather the guy pushing his fruit cart out into the middle of the street.
Yeah, you have to establish, give him a line or show him in the background doing something so that when you come back to him, you're like, ah, fuck you, buddy.
Well, the best line you could ever give him is, my cabbages! So, that's... No, I agree. I like that a lot. So there you go. I think we actually... I was worried we wouldn't be able to come up with a good answer to that. Last question of the day.
Ooh-hoo.
Also from Lauren Brinkman. She sent us three. And this is going to be a weird one. What is the worst thing that you have eaten? Anyone who wants to jump in. I need to think about it.
Okay. Worst thing I've eaten.
Oh, I just got it.
Oh, go for it.
You want me to go for it? I forget the name of it, but I have tried I believe it's either Icelandic or Finnish delicacy that is made by hanging shark in a building until it rots.
Yeah, the rotten shark.
Yeah. So I have tried eating rotten, dried, raw shark.
Yeah, that sounds awful.
That doesn't sound good. Is that a
no.
delicacy? Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They have one where they just bury the fish in dirt and then come get it like a week later.
And then they have another one where they nail it to a wooden board and then dip it in lye and then leave it in the sun. It's like people in those countries just hate fish.
I guess it's fish punishing.
Yeah. They're really just torturing fish and then they eat it, I guess, as a final act of desecration. I mean... I feel like with a rotted shark, you're just as likely to, like, come in there and spank it and pee on it as you are to eat it. So that makes sense to me. But, yeah, it was fetid and ultra sour. That was the weirdest thing about it. The sourness was beyond compare. So, anyone else?
Yeah, worst thing that I ever ate was punishment for subconscious racism. I had the good fortune of my life in being able to travel to South Africa. And one night when we were there, we ate out at this like supremely fancy restaurant, probably one of the fanciest places that I've ever been in my life. And for like our appetizer, both me and my little sister and our cousin ordered tomato soup. And what came out when they were starting to bring things out for people, everybody else got their food and they placed in front of us a massive bowl, and at the bottom of the bowl was like this little bit of bread with like a piece of meat on top of it, and all of us like looked around and go, did we say it the wrong way? What's wrong with it? Like,
they brought you communal
and I went
soup.
To eat it, and it was basically essentially a really dry, flavorless crouton and like a smelly piece of meat that didn't taste super great. And I was like, this is terrible. And then like a minute later, they came out and poured the soup over that crouton. And the soup was delicious.
That's great. I thought you were going to, I mean, my girlfriend spent a couple months in South Africa as well. And she always tells a story about eating Smiley,
No, which, no.
So I figured that's where you were going. If for people who don't know, Smiley is a sheep's head that's served basically boiled and with everything still on there. So it's a visual feast for the eyes if you are not from South Africa. You have to be ready for the eyeballs looking back at you.
No, yeah.
Basically.
It was me assuming, like, me being a stupid idiot teenager going, they don't know what soup is. What's wrong with this place?
Well, I can't tell you if you order nachos there. The way they do it is every nacho has everything nacho built into it.
Which is the best.
That's great.
Yeah. Yo, yeah. Super good. None of that big pile of cheese on a big pile of chips, which is also awesome. Don't get me wrong. It's more like they bring out 15 chips and every chip has a nacho platter on it.
Oh,
it's great.
Man.
All right. We're coming to John. Not a very food adventurous guy.
Well, thing is, even if I go someplace, I'm generally not getting anything that I know I don't already dislike. So, you know, like the worst things I've had are just things that the first time I had them, I went, oh, that isn't very good, and then I don't have anything like that again. So, you know, mostly stuff with fish, because fish is nasty.
I was going to say, you're not a very...
I hate the sea and all that dwells within.
So you're going to be pretty bland on this one. You've never really been a big, I'll eat this even though I shouldn't.
Oh, yeah, no. Guy. If they bring something out and I'm like, oh, that looks and smells like hot garbage, I'm like, well, that's okay. I'll just not have that thing.
See, I'm in the vein where I will eat anything once to prove it, I get to the point where I'm like, I'll eat on dares. So I've eaten at least four or five different kinds of bug.
Oh, there you go. On a dare, probably the worst thing I had was like a smoothie made out of like that, the fucking things that you get where it's like, oh, it's hot sauce, soy sauce, peanut butter, milk, and we've put it in a blender and now you have to drink it.
Ugh.
Okay, that's the worst.
So you've never done, for example, have you ever been at a party where the alcohol on tap was like something just horrible because you were 15 and it was like, what's this? Listerine and Kahlua, figure it out.
We got a handle full of rubbing alcohol, so I don't know, go to town.
Yeah. I got banana schnapps and Fireball whiskey. And, I don't know, something from my mom's medicine cabinet.
Oh, sweet. Fireball and banana whiskey. I'm going to make some Bananas Foster's drink.
Well, actually,
yeah,
now,
that could
now
be
I'm
good.
On board.
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time coming up with gross alcohol after my Kahlua and Listerine beginning. Anyway, that was all the questions, and that means that we are basically wrapping this show up.
Oh, yeah, we have gone a little long.
We actually have gone a little long, but that's okay. It's a special episode,
so
folks will stop by to visit, and they won't mind the length. James, we can't thank you enough for stopping by.
Guys, it was so much fun stopping by. I love listening to you guys every week, and it was so much fun to join in.
I'm glad. And you really jumped in. You had the spirit of answering our crazy questions, which is super fun. So, as always, this has been the Afterthought Podcast. You can find us at SystemMasteryPodcast.com or any one of our various social media channels. Support us on the Patreon if you want. Stick around, because in 2 days from the release of this episode, or hopefully in 2 days from the release of this episode, we'll have our next Movie Mastery.
Ooh.
I don't want to give you too big of a hint, but I will give you a one-word hint. Clowns. That's it.
Jesus.
That's all you get.
Yeah. There you go. It's going to be an awesome episode, though. I can tell you right now. So, once again, special thanks to our guest, James D'Amato.
And where can they find you?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
You can find me and most of what I do over at oneshotpodcast.com. And if you want to tweet more dumb questions at me, you can find me on Twitter at oneshotrpg.
Yep.
Fabulous.
And we both really enjoy all the shows he does, so there's great stuff. That's a lot of our fans came to us after hearing us on his Critical Success show, so that's been great. So thanks very much. And
as always,
find us on our various social media channels and listen in. We'll be back in a week with another horrible role-playing game review.
Yes, we will.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God, we will.
It's the best. All right, thanks, and have a lovely night, week, thing.
Times.
Times.
Great sign-off, guys.